The following program is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and was first broadcast in 1984. The World of Islam, Voices of the Resurgence. The program is introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings.
The current resurgence of Islam is a varied, often chaotic set of responses to centuries of decline, weakness, and foreign domination. It is also often inspired by the belief that Islam alone can restore the greatness of the past and provide a valid model for the future, that foreign models, Western liberal democracy and Soviet communism, have failed the Islamic world. In this program, we're going to take a closer look at some of the most important groups and thinkers in the vanguard of the resurgence and the Islamic order they would like to create. The program is reported and narrated by Julian Crandall-Hollick.
For a true Muslim, there's nothing at all strange in seeking to reintroduce Islamic precepts into today's society. In the West, we would call this fundamentalism. Kamal Farooqi is a lawyer in Islamabad, Pakistan.
In the case of Islam, this would mean going back to a literal interpretation of the revealed book of Muslims, that is to say the Quran, and the significance of the sunnah of the Prophet, that is to say his behavior, his practices and precepts.
To us, fundamentalism is scarcely a compliment. It suggests an extreme, almost irrational conservatism, a flying in the face of social and scientific progress. For the Muslim who wants to reintroduce Islam into public life, a more accurate term would probably be Islamic activist. An activist would be someone for whom Islam is an ideological blueprint for changing society, not just a tradition or a set of private beliefs. All activists want to see more Islamic values in their respective societies, but there are enormous differences of temperament and style among them. Some believe in gradual evolution and compromise with Western values. Others reject this in favor of the purity of violent and total change, while still others dream of recreating an Islamic society as it existed 1400 years ago in Mecca and Medina. On the other side of the fence are those who believe in what Kamal Farooqi calls Islamic modernism.
Which is the belief that the message of Islam is both timeless and universal, that the Quran, God's revealed word, is timeless and universal, and by that very token, it must be applicable to the modern age without deluding oneself as to the enduring significance of modern developments. In other words, there is a search for identifying the principles of the Quran and the Prophet's Sunnah in modern terms, relevant to the modern age.
At the beginning of the 20th century, there were great thinkers in the Islamic world, men such as Al-Afghani, Muhammad Abdu, or Rashid Rido. Each, in their rather different ways, tried to reconcile Islam with the modern world. Surprisingly, the current resurgence appears to have produced few, if any, great thinkers, although some have exerted considerable influence, especially among the young. One such was the Pakistani Maulana Abu Lala Maududi, founder of the Jamaati Islami Party based in Pakistan, but which has important sister parties in neighboring Afghanistan, India, and Bangladesh.
His work is a critique of Muslim life from an Islamic perspective.
Khurshid Ahmed is a leading Muslim activist who knew Maududi well.
So it's not merely a critique of the West, but also a critique of the Muslim society. And he has shown how to rejuvenate, how to revive, how to re-strengthen, how to make the Muslims active, effective, a culture-producing force once again.
Maududi's main contribution was to popularize the notion that the answer to most, if not all, the problems besetting the Islamic world lay in restoring the unity of Islam as a total way of life. Once again, Khurshid Ahmed in Islamabad.
When Pakistan was established and many other Muslim countries became free, the question arose, what is an Islamic State? And most of the people were saying that Islamic State would mean a modern state which says that Islam is its religion. And there is a ministry taking care of certain religious rituals like Hajj, like Awqaf, like Salat, like Zakah, etc. Now Maududi is one of those persons who have said that this is not the position. An Islamic State is a state which is ideological, which is committed to the positive ideal of refashioning, influencing the whole fabric of social life from the ideals, values, and principles of Islam.
In pre-revolutionary Iran, two of the leaders of the intellectual revival of Islam were Ali Shariati and Ayatollah Murtada Mutahhari. Both succeeded in making Shiite thought relevant to an Iranian youth in search of new answers and certainties. Ali Shariati, for instance, by recasting Shiite thought within the language of neo-Marxist liberation ideology. Another major figure was the Egyptian Said Khutbeh. Fuad Zakaria is an Egyptian philosopher now living in Kuwait.
Well, I think he had a very clear notion of what, for instance, a capitalist way of life means and what a socialist way of life means. And he tried to stir a middle course between the two sides, but in a rather intelligent way. That's to say, when you read his writings, you can at least conclude that this man knows something about what's happening around him in the world, and he's trying to find a special way for Islam among the two, between the two major tendencies prevailing in the world.
Said Khutbeh was also a leading member of the Ikhwan, or Muslim Brotherhood, the stepfather of many of today's radical Islamic groups. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in the late 1920s in Egypt by Hassan al-Banna. It quickly grew into an anti-colonial movement, challenging the secular nationalist Waft Party. At the height of its influence in the 1940s, the Ikhwan ran schools, hospitals, and factories, as well as a secret army. Nasser exploited the Ikhwan's popularity to seize and then consolidate power in 1952. Then he turned on them, executed many of the leadership, and banned them from public life. But the influence of the Ikhwan survived the movement's political eclipse in Egypt and spread across the Arabic world. Here was a movement telling Arab youth that yes, Islam was relevant to the problems of their societies. Mohammed Sakhar, now living in Amman, Jordan, was then a young student in Cairo.
Now, Al-Ikhwan Muslimun, the Muslim Brotherhood, for me, I believe they wanted to build a new society, progressive society, developed society, a highly educated society, use knowledge and technology to the best, and in the same time, keep harmony with Islam in real terms. So, social legislation should be Islamic. Political theory and practice should be Islamic. Economic institutions should be Islamic. Educational policy will be Islamic. In other words, all social life is supposed consistent with the Islamic outlook.
Today, the Muslim Brotherhood is still banned in Egypt, although its aging leadership has long since renounced violence as a means of establishing an Islamic order. In Syria, the Ikhwan remains powerful as the focus of opposition to the secularist Ba'athist regime of Hafez al-Assad. The movement is officially tolerated in neighboring Jordan and in the Sudan, where its leader is Dr. Hassan al-Tarabi, until recently that country's attorney general. Tarabi rejects the notion that the Brotherhood is conservative.
In fact, it's not a conservative movement. It's poised not only against the external challenge of materialism, secularism, nationalism coming from Western culture, it's also poised against traditional conservative Islam. And in some parts of the Muslim world, there is a very serious conflict between the traditionalists, the mullahs, the ulama, the scholars, who are deeply versed in traditional literature, and the revivalists, who are new elements, who are familiar with the contemporary state of things, and who want to apply Islam, the values and the rules of Islam, to a contemporary society.
Today's militants in the Arab world are very much the stepchildren of the Muslim Brotherhood.
They are people, mostly, who are young. They are in their 20s and 30s.
Saad Ibrahim is an Egyptian sociologist who has made a special study of militant Islamic groups across the Arab world.
They are educated, either students in college or recent college graduates. They are high achievers. Most of them are in medicine, in engineering, and in our part of the world, to go to these colleges, you must have very high scores in high school, secondary school, state exams. They also are people from lower middle class, and I must emphasize this point. And finally, they are people from rural background or recent, or small town background, who have recently migrated to the big city to go to the university or to work after graduation from the university.
According to Saad Ibrahim, this pattern is repeated throughout the Arabic world, from Morocco to Iraq.
They come to the city, they see things that they're not known or experienced directly before. They see, first of all, that despite their intelligence, their dynamism, their aspirations, that the future is very dim for them. Second, they see the contradiction of their society in a concentrated, dramatic way in the big city. Third, they see the presence, the foreign presence, the high profile of Americans or British or French or Germans in their country. Fourthly, they see the absence of any credible regime to deal either with their own aspirations as individuals or to deal with the socio-economic situation or with the national question.
It's therefore perhaps not really surprising that so many of these youngsters turn to Islam as the possible solution. Once again, Saad Ibrahim in Cairo.
They raise the slogan of Quran, the Sharia, their principles revolve, or their quest revolves around the importance of restoring an Islamic social order. And they believe that only with an Islamic social order we will be able to take care of all the problems, whether they are individual problems or socioeconomic problems or national and international problems. And they attribute all the difficulties that themselves as individuals, as well as their class, their society, they attribute all these problems to the fact that our rulers have deserted Islam, have strayed away from the straight path of Islam, and the only way to correct this is by an Islamic restoration.
In much of the Islamic world today, this commitment to an Islamic restoration is publicly proclaimed by both sexes. Young men sport long beards, while girls frequently adopt the long dress, headscarf, or veil characteristic of Arab Muslim society. Maha Salah is a young Egyptian journalist who chose to publicly abandon Western dress in favor of the hijab, or headscarf.
We were taught in school that Islam is a religion which can be applied anywhere and anytime, and I wanted to make sure of that. So it was very understandable to try to apply it on myself. And dressing this way was one of the things which I thought I have to do. First of all, to prove to myself that I'm on the right track. I simply wanted to be consistent within myself, to do the things which I believe in and things which I should do.
One of the still unexplained mysteries about the current resurgence is that the vast majority of young militants come not from the social sciences, but from science and engineering faculties. Dr. Abdullah Omar Nassif, now Secretary General of the Muslim World League based in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, is, for example, a trained geologist.
I realize that there's something, there is a glory, there is a creator really behind all those marvelous facts of life in the field of geology or chemistry or thing. And I think I have to think and rethink about my attitude towards life. And there should be a creator and a very wise creator who really has given all those laws and produced all these facts of life. So this is one example. So in our university, in other universities, in Egypt, in other places, students of medicine, engineering, sciences, they are the most religious and they care about people even.
There is at least one partial explanation for this generalized concentration of activists in the natural and applied sciences. For by and large, they are the students sent to the West for advanced training. Exposure to Western society merely reinforces their commitment to Islam, as Kamal Hassan explains in Kuala Lumpur.
The moment these young people go abroad, mainly to England, to study, they were also exposed to the new Islamic awareness that had been created through the literature, which was quite different from the older generation who went to England to enjoy English culture and became willingly Anglophiles. Whereas the younger generation went to England and to America to benefit from Western science and technology, but to be very critical of Western culture. The values, the cultural values, were not absorbed by the Muslims, were rejected, in fact, rather radically.
Hassan al-Tarabi, for example, went to study in London and Paris.
If I did not watch out, I knew then I would be washed away in that culture. And one particular area, of course, was exposure to a society where free sex relations prevailed. There, you are not subject to any control, and you are faced with a very serious challenge. And you have to rely upon your own strength, spiritual strength, to stabilize your character and hold fast to your beliefs.
Anwar Ibrahim in Malaysia never went abroad to study. The son of a prominent Malay politician, Anwar was sent by the British to a select private school in Penang to be turned into a westernized Malay. But once again, contact with Western culture had exactly the opposite effect from that intended.
I objected even the idea, the insistence of eating with a fork and spoon. And we, many of us, really rebel against the idea. It's the question of eating in a clean manner. They should be asked to wash our hands properly. That we realize has nothing to do with Malay or Malaysian or Islam.
Anwar went to the University of Malaya just after independence in the mid-60s.
No, we were then students in the various universities, and we were quite unhappy with the state of affairs, of what we considered rampant corruption, moral decadence in the society. We weren't happy with many of the economic programs, and nothing significant is done to alleviate the conditions of the poor, particularly in the rural areas. We were still, the country is still uncertain over question of issues like national education and even the national language. So these issues really brought us together, and we decided to form a movement in order that these issues could be presented in a more organized manner.
The result was the formation of ABIM, the Islamic Youth Movement of Malaysia, which quickly grew to become the most powerful force for Islamization in the country.
We have a number of increasing number of Malay students realizing that they need to understand their tradition, their religion, and not to depend only on the given Western solution in this country. And it is partly the failure of Western educated leaders that brought us to be more interested in Islam. And we started learning. It's basically, it was a learning process, educative process. We started learning, trying to understand the Quran, trying to understand the traditions, getting ourselves exposed to literature on Islam, having discussions on the subject, and see where some of these values could be applied in the society.
The presence of large Chinese and Indian minorities within Malaysia also led Abim and Anwar to adopt a gradualist educational approach to Islamization. Abim has been highly successful establishing its own schools across the country. Anwar Ibrahim is now a minister in the Malaysian government. Like Hassan Atarabi in the Sudan, he has chosen to work for change from within the existing system. But there are also other Islamic activists in Malaysia who reject this gradualist approach. One such group is Darul Akam, whose members wear long green robes and live in self-sufficient communes. We visited one community in the jungle in Kelantan State, near the border with Thailand, and asked its leader, Hashim Ahmed, to explain the movement's goals.
What's written here? Matlamat SR Akam ialah untuk melahirkan peribadi ulama yang bertakwa.
They believe that such a society was just, was fair, was productive, and was dignified. And nobody in that society was in need, at least not for a long time, before he was discovered quickly by the community of the believers. Such a society was free of sin for the most part, and if there were sinners, there were very few, and they were either reformed or eliminated or weeded out very quickly. It was a society on the rise. It was a society that controlled the world, or at least dominated in the world at the time.
Does this mean returning pure and simple to the society of 1400 years ago? Not according to Muslim activist Anis Ahmed in Islamabad.
Islamic notion of going back to the past has been misunderstood by the West completely. It is not trying to imitate in the dress and manner and things of the people of Makkah or Medina, rather following the principles of the Quran and Sunnah and applying them for a modern society.
The Jamaat-e-Islami in Pakistan is generally considered more conservative than either Abim or the Muslim Brothers. Yet even Mian Tufail, Maududi's successor as party leader, admits that some adaptation to modern conditions is necessary.
It means to practice Islam as it was practiced during the days of the Prophet and the four caliphs. But it does not mean that the problems and the things that have arisen after that period, they should not be solved. They will be solved in the light of what has been done by the Prophet and the four caliphs, in the light of Ijtihad.
Groups such as Abim, the Muslim Brothers, and the Jamaat-e-Islami favor a gradualist, non-violent approach to achieve their goals. Many of the smaller, more radical groups that have sprung up in the past decade, however, refuse this approach. Saad Ibrahim in Cairo.
Others, like Repentance and Holy Flight, Jihad, Islamic Liberation Organizations, and many, are too impatient. They don't want to wait. They want to have a confrontation, as they call it, an outrage for God. Almost like the weatherman in the United States in the 60s. The revolution is the act. It's a propaganda by deed. Let us die for Islam, and our death will make us martyrs, will create more people. And of course, the model in Iran is very inspiring to many of them.
The ultimate goal of both gradualists and radicals is the creation of an Islamic state. But what exactly is an Islamic state? Hassan Atarabi in Khartoum.
The Islamic state is based on consultation, or shura. That means it's a democratic society wherein everybody should participate. Thus, the ruled and the rulers should jointly participate in an Islamic state. And it's based on
the juristic principle of ijma, or consensus.
There are some major differences, however, between this Islamic State and democracy as we understand it in the West. In the Islamic State, ultimate sovereignty rests not with the people, but with God, whose law, the Sharia, is the ultimate constitution. The rulers act as regents of God, to be removed if they break the Sharia. This leaves the difficulty of deciding who has the authority to interpret the Sharia and determine whether the rulers are acting in accordance with it. Another question is whether only Muslims are allowed to vote or hold elected office. Fatih Osman is a former Muslim brother and now editor of the Islamic monthly Arabia. Osman sees problems ahead.
Consultation means participation in the decision-making. This public participation in the decision-making is very essential. But how can we reach it? How can we achieve it? The only ways, the only channels, the only forms that we have now is the democratic forms.
For Osman, the absence of any existing model of Islamic democracy dictates one choice.
I think we have these Western formulas, and we have to stick to them, not to waste our time, and to waste the time of Muslims, and to waste the time of Muslim movements, the time and the energy, in trying to dig in classical compilations of classical jurists to invent something new. It is a long process of development, and it is better to make use of the mature and rich Western experience than to invent something from just the literary or the theoretical point of view, which was not practiced at all in any time.
In the Third World, where monarchy and dictatorship are all too common, the call for an Islamic State is a thinly veiled invitation to revolution. Mohammed Saka's frustrations may be prophetic.
We have wealth. We have everything available. We have crude oil. We have billions of dollars everywhere, etc. We have huge resources. We are very rich, but we are the poorest people on this earth of today. Why? Because our decisions are not made by our people, are made from above, and people don't care.
You have been listening to Voices of the Resurgence, another in the series The World of Islam. The program was introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings. Music consultant was Professor Brian Silver of Duke University. Production secretary was Martine Crandall-Hollick. The technical producer was Peter K. Storkerson, and the program was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick. Consultants for this program were Professors John Esposito of Holy Cross College and the late Richard Mitchell of the University of Michigan, to whose memory this program is dedicated. The World of Islam is a production of IBA in cooperation with WBUR Boston and is made possible in part with a grant from the Islamic Society of North America. If you'd like to comment on this program or to order cassette copies and transcripts, please phone area code 508-486-9180 or fax number 508-486-9652 during regular business hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.